You're listening to the Belfer Center's Office Hours. Watch highlights from this and other Office Hours interviews on YouTube at youtube.com/BelferCenter. In this episode, we sat down with Mike Murphy, one of the Republican Party's most successful political media consultants, who's overseen the strategy for more than 26 successful gubernatorial and senatorial campaigns. Murphy is also a writer and producer in the entertainment industry and a Belfer Center Senior Fellow.
You're a political media strategist and consultant.
Allegedly. After calling this election wrong in every dimension, I'm looking into a new career of Quiznos.
Oh, yeah?
Yes. I've been, for more than 30 years, I've helped both companies and interest groups, but candidates as well, message and organize their campaigns and then handled all the advertising and strategy.
Okay, maybe you can tell me something, because what in heaven's name is going on right now? Does anyone even know what their party stands for anymore?
Well, it's a muddled time. You know, normally we have a lot of clarity of a presidential election, but we had kind of this super outsider candidate, Donald Trump, who not only rolled over the establishment of the Republican Party to win a real upset as an insurgent, but also kind of broke through and put the Democratic Party into a bit of a tailspin. Though they had some structural problems beforehand, I think. If you look at state legislative races and other indicators over the last couple of cycles, we Republicans have been doing better and better. But it was a bit of a perfect storm. On the other hand, who would have thought we have a at least proclaimed protectionist Republican as now the president-elect of the United States? So it was quite an implosion. I don't want to use the word implosion, more of a rebuilding and reshuffling of the coalition kind of election, and people are still reacting to it.
I mean, do you think there's something to be united around anymore, or is it kind of in disarray, and are they going to have to rebuild over the next four years?
In the U.S., we don't have the same party identification orientation that other Western democracies do. Often they publish a party manifesto that's very carefully followed. We tend to run somewhat more personality-based campaigns with ideology attached. And Donald Trump was more of a personality and persona protest candidate than he was really an ideological or policy candidate. So what the Trump administration is really going to do, we know from some of the speeches what they promise, but what the reality is or will be is still an open question. So I think we're in somewhat new territory here because we really do have an insurgent candidate who came out of nowhere, won a big upset, a narrow win. You know, the Democrats argue he lost the popular vote by at least a million, which is true. But he's definitely not from the normal political precincts. I think most of his voters were voting to blow up the system. Yeah. So what that turns into in government now is the big question, and I don't think anybody knows.
And you, now, you're a Republican strategist. How would you advise the Democrats?
Well, I'm going to get a migraine just thinking about it. I was in a weird position this year because I was an anti-Trump Republican. I was publicly opposed to Trump being elected president. I did not vote for him. I didn't endorse Hillary Clinton. I live in California, which was the state she was going to win anywhere, anyhow, so my vote didn't really count. As far as advising the Democrats, I think we're getting the real first election data in after the election, where you actually look at precincts and real returns, not just modeling and exit polling. And it's a pretty clear story. The calculus of American politics has been that the Republicans are non-competitive with minority voters, and that share of the vote, particularly Latino, is exploding. So therefore, it's almost impossible for Republican candidates to win a general election. But we just had a Republican candidate win one, including carrying states that we Republicans have not carried since the 80s. So what happened? There was a collapse in a couple of votes that are very important to the Democrats. In the Midwestern industrial cities, particularly Detroit and Milwaukee, because Michigan and Wisconsin were so key in this equation, African-American turnout was way low. She did not need it to match Obama levels, but she did not need it as low as it was. In Detroit alone, or Wayne County, which is the county that is both the suburbs, some of the suburbs, and the city of Detroit, she ran 78,000 votes behind Obama. She lost the state probably by only 12,000 votes. So collapse there of enthusiasm in the base. The African-American base. Second, the Democrat theory of winning because of the strong minority vote still presumes a certain amount of white blue-collar support, loyal white blue-collar Democrats. And those numbers in many places, you look at like Wilkes-Barre, Pennsylvania is a good indicator, were record low for her. So if I were the Democrats, I would spend less time in D.C. focusing on what we Republicans call, a little bit unfairly, the kale messages of kind of well-educated yuppies.
Kale?
Yeah, the kale. You know,
you don't like kale?
I think kale is great. That's delicious. If I were a Democratic strategist, I'd worry less about voters who are very conversant in the culinary preparation of kale and worry more about people who swing a hammer for a living. Because those are the voters that she did not get enough of. She doesn't have to win them, but she has to have a hunk of them, and she got wiped out there. Of course, they highly resonated to Trump on trade and other issues, and that's why he's president-elect.
Do you think there is any chance we'll see a new party emerge from the Trump election?
You know, there's always kind of a demand for a new party, but there's a big question of it is if it's a majority demand. You know, it could be kind of a niche demand, which then I think would be less stabilizing than people assume a third party would be as any kind of answer. And our system is built, kind of the distribution mechanics of it is built for a two-party system. The mechanics of getting on the ballot and everything are extremely difficult for third-party candidates. So I think a real third party with a shot at getting a plurality of the vote is a long way off.
Okay, I want to talk a little bit about your background.
Yeah, sure.
Now, I read somewhere that you dropped out of college.
I did. Yeah. I ran away to join the circus of politics. I was going to the Foreign Service School at Georgetown, learning how to fight the Cold War, Russian Area Studies, back in 1980. And I was hired by a congressman and his consultant at the time, who was favored to lose. So they couldn't get anybody who had any real background. But I knew a little bit about making radio ads and things like that. And I took the job.
You dropped out of college at Georgetown to join a campaign that was projected to lose.
Not quite. I didn't drop out of college. I just did the campaign while I was in college.
Understood.
And the guy wins.
Okay.
So I'm still officially on a leave of absence from Georgetown. And negotiations have opened up with the president's office of what it would take for me to actually get my degree. I just don't want it to be a Disney movie of the world's oldest student. But I dropped out. I took a leave of absence. God bless Austin Ranney, who signed off on it. And I never went back. I started running campaigns and had a fascinating time and stayed very interested in foreign policy stuff. That's why I'm connected here to Belfer. I never got the ticket. And my Russian is all gone, too. And Foreign Service School back then, and I believe now, they had it's basically the only college I believe, or at least it used to be, probably still is, where to get the Bachelor of Science in Foreign Service degree, you had to pass oral exams and you were basically State Department ready for the Foreign Service test. On the language side. And I can barely remember how to count in Russian, let alone pass anything like that. So I've got a lot of work to do.
And then you've been living in LA for how long now?
Well, I originally lived, kind of split my time between, based mostly in Washington, D.C., but a lot of time in New York City. And then when there was this action movie star who was running for governor of California, I went to work for him. One thing led to another. And when Arnold Schwarzenegger was elected, he really wanted me to stay for the first year as his political advisor. So I commuted back and forth. And I thought, I really like California. I was always interested in show business, the creative side. So I started selling scripts. And I thought, why don't I live here? So I moved to California to I love everything about it except the communism. And I now don't own a house in D.C. anymore. But I'm back and forth a lot. But I'm based in Los Angeles.
City of Angels.
It is a great city. It is a great state. Yes.
Now, you work in entertainment, as you said, in Hollywood. So do you even see a difference between Hollywood and American politics?
Oh, well, they're both theatrical. There are similarities. Yeah. I mean, now, look, we have a reality star, president-elect. I mean, if Donald Trump hadn't spent 10 years on primetime television, even if all he was doing was teaching Gary Busey how to work a snow cone machine for a product placement-based show, it still created that identity, what the Hollywood folks would call the pre-aware title of Trump as the can-do, fix-it guy. And he took that asset into the presidential campaign, and it worked tremendously for him. So there are real parallels.
Do you think we'll see more celebrities entering politics? I mean, you don't have to pay for brand recognition anymore.
Right.
You know. Do we think...
That's the whole concept of the pre-aware title.
Yeah.
Why they made... There's a movie script floating around Hollywood about Slinky, the toy. Because they're thinking it's a lot less money to sell a movie concept and people already know what the character is. It saves a lot of money in marketing, which is a huge cost in the motion picture business. Yes, I think this happened with Arnold. After Arnold Schwarzenegger was elected governor, and I would say he was very different than Trump because he took the preparation on the policy side extremely seriously and had a very muscular policy team working for him from the very beginning.
Muscular, you mean that metaphorically?
I mean muscular and brain power. Arnold kind of took care of the regular muscle stuff. But he,
seen those videos.
He was very, very shrewd about that. He knew that when he won, he would want to govern from day one. He didn't want to be in the situation that President-elect Trump is in right now, where there are third grade fights breaking out in the transition team, which is, you know, you wanted to be prepared. But the point was, when Arnold won, other famous entertainment people started looking around thinking, well, wait a minute, why can't I do this? So you none of them ultimately ran, but you started to see maneuvering. And I think Trump may have that same effect.
Are you trying to tell me that Morgan Freeman is considering a presidential run?
I'll tell you, the most candidate capable on the Democratic side person I've seen operate in Hollywood is George Clooney.
Oh.
He could be a terrific candidate if he chose to.
Is he considering it?
I don't speak for Clooney. I'm a Republican. I just know the chops when I see him. And Clooney's very good.
George Clooney.
Yeah. I'm not trying to put him in the race. I'm just saying.
If you're watching.
If you're watching. But I'm sure he's already thought about it. Who knows what he'll do.
All right.
But I've seen him operate at policy forums and all that. He does his homework. He presents well. He's just somebody. Another person I believe who might have presidential, or I shouldn't say presidential, I should say political ambitions, could be Senate, governor, who knows, dog catcher, is Ben Affleck.
Oh.
He's another person, I think, who kind of notices politics.
He's made some great movies.
Look, if you know how to communicate and you're a disciplined person, which most movie stars are, because it's not easy to become a big movie star, in Affleck's case, and Clooney too, they both also directed features successfully, you have a lot of the skill set. So, we'll see.
All right.
Our pop culture and our politics have come together for good or bad. So I would not be surprised if you see more people look at what Trump did and say, why not me?
Now, a little bit before, you talked about, you mentioned data earlier.
Yeah.
And there was an interview a few weeks ago, around election night, or maybe the day after, you said, this is the night that data has died.
Yeah, it was a tweet, actually, which is, I think, appropriate to comment on data. Do it by Twitter.
Now, has data died, or did data just discover a family data didn't know about?
You know, this is an interesting kind of case study of Twitter. That thing was repeated like 1,000 times. It kind of got a life of its own, and people were misconstruing it a little bit, because I was talking about data in the narrow term that political consultants talk about data, because I was talking to my peers. Data is how we refer to as data is what we used to describe polling data and other what we call voter data. So I meant this was the night that all the polling indicators that had always been more or less true in the past, or at least far more often right than wrong, turned out to be wrong. And what happened was the wider community of political scientists and empiricists and other people of data said, no, wait a minute, data's not dead, it's just incorrectly used, blah, blah, blah. I was using the political shorthand for polling. So it was, I think, I haven't answered some of the people who are tweeting back because I get their point. But data as the political shorthand, the lexicon for polling, was the night the polling was all mostly wrong, including the exit polling.
But polling has bounced back. I mean, Dewey beats Trump 1948.
I'm long data. What I said in that tweet, and you can look it up at Murphy Mike, was for 30 years I've worked with data, and tonight was the night data died. And what I meant to say, and I thought I said, and people in the 300 people I care about in national politics who know this stuff know what I was saying was, wow, the polling was really wrong, and for 30 years it's been right. Now, what does that make me think about tomorrow morning? It'll be more right than wrong. We can get better at it, though. It is much harder to do public opinion polling the way we used to, which is telephone-based interviews, because of cell phones and because of completion rate problems, particularly among some demography segments and cohorts that are hard to get. Now, the other thing I was getting at, without meaning to get too laborious here, but it's an important issue within the community I operate in, is there's been a schism for a while between the traditional data consumers who are heavily based on public opinion research that's more traditional, and the data analytics folks and campaigns who, and I'm being a little unfair to them, but not too unfair, have often been a lot of folks who say, you idiots, if you're polling, don't know anything. You old guys, you don't get it. Wait a minute, I got to Snapchat somebody. Okay, let me get back to the conversation. You old guys don't get it. We don't really need your traditional polling. We have data analytics. Which is more of a CRM model where you know your voter very well and you kind of track them through the process. It is a highly credible rumor now that the Clinton people turned off their traditional polling in Wisconsin, Michigan, and even Pennsylvania a few weeks out because they were so confident of their analytics, which proved to be essentially wrong. So I was also kind of slapping back at the Dan analytic crowd, which had become, instead of an extremely important tool that I use myself, a bit of a religion, mm-hmm. which is a mistake.
Understood.
Well, so that's what I was trying to do.
Let's talk a little about the internet. Does the internet allow people to be more mean? I mean,
yes.
Why are people so mean on those Reddit and YouTube comments? Why can't people just be nice?
Well, the internet is a way to put a message in all kind of places for free, with great speed, with none of the kind of social interface consequences of rudeness. You know, because it's kind of the anonymous note. Like, it's not a say it to their face. Social media is a virtual world where you can be things that either aren't true or you can be a warped version of your own personality. It's funny. On Twitter, my favorite button used to be the block button. Because I thought, somebody's kind of irritating. I'll just block them. I'll throw them off the island. They don't pay to be here. I would then get emails. They'd track my email down. And why'd you block me? You know, and they were these rude, horrible people on Twitter with that distance, that digital distance. But then once they were blocked, I get these letters from like nice librarians who their feelings were so hurt. You know, you can see both sides of the personality and you got a better idea of the whole person. There is something about digital media that allows you license to be an exaggerated, ruder, meaner version of yourself.
Do you think that'll translate to real life at all? Or?
Well, that's a good question for sociologists to take a look at. I do believe we have become more of a garage-out society, as urban planners say, with less. And there's a movement to bring this back in urban planning where people don't even really know their neighbors. You know, it's funny, in the old days in politics, we would organize on the precinct basis, the smallest block of voting. You would have a captain who would go door-to-door, know that person is this, that person. Here's somebody who had a real problem with their insurance company. We ought to talk to them about our plan. You would whip, as we say in politics, canvas your precinct. Now we organize more in the digital precinct, which is your friends on Facebook, because most people have more of a relationship with their old college roommate who lives 1,000 miles away, or their sister, the teacher, lives 500 miles away, than the person three houses down in their neighborhood. So that old building block, which had physical proximity, and as well as maybe a political connection or a social one, has been broken up, and digital's been part of that.
Do you have a favorite emoji that you use with your best buds?
You know, to be honest, my wife got the app where you do a cartoon version of yourself.
Bitmoji.
Yeah, Bitmoji. I've got
excellent.
Bitmoji. I have sent a few Bitmojis in my time. But like most apps, I find it has a half-life of interest. So after about 14 days of it, I use it
You got a Bitmoji on you?
I haven't. Here's the other problem. Oh. The Bitmoji people, desperate for revenue, like many of these apps that don't have much, you know, that's the revenue neutral phase. I do a lot of work in Silicon Valley. They keep updating it. And every time they update it, I have to go through the permissions chain again. So I've stopped.
Oh, you've stopped.
It's not worth enough to me.
So you can't even see your Bitmoji.
So the third, I will try to dig it up for you, but it'll take some time.
Okay.
And I don't think the app will operate anymore. Because I don't have enough time in my life to satisfy their need for constant updates and my need to go through the permission chain. I do not get the value from the app to
all
be
right.
worth that, which is why I believe that Bitmoji Incorporated will be gone in a year. That's why I'd never invest in it.
Sorry, Bitmoji.
Yeah, sorry, Bitmoji. Though my wife is a loyal user.
Yeah. So a little bit about Trump. One thing I just don't understand, maybe you can help me out with this. Mm-hmm. One thing I just don't understand is everyone saying that this election was a repudiation of the elite.
Right.
Trump is a member of the elite. Trump is a mega rich guy who went to a fancy school for undergraduate education.
Right, sort
He's
of.
Connected to, he went to UPenn, he went to Ivy, he went to Wharton. That's about as fancy as it gets.
It took him a while to get into you, but anyway, there's a whole nother story. But yes, your point is right. He is a billionaire from Manhattan who ran against the elite.
What are people talking about?
Is there not a certain hypocrisy there?
Yeah.
I think it's more the cultural elite. It's like the old joke about Nixon. If we'd only let him into Harvard, we would have solved a lot of problems. And so Trump has always believed himself to be an outsider. He's originally from the outer boroughs in New York. He's never really been accepted by the people whose love he craved in Manhattan. So even though it is true, he is economically definitely part of the smallest elite you can be, a billionaire. Geographically, he does live in a glittering tower in Manhattan. He's still, at least in his mind, and I think in the minds of the social strata there, a bit of an outsider. And his voters are outsider because there is still, I guarantee you, a huge cultural difference between all my dear friends here at Harvard University and the iron workers 150 yards behind me from Dorchester, and I'll bet there are more Trump voters back there than there are in the building. And I don't think a lot of people, there is that difference. And that tension in politics, because they're worried about different things than I think we are here. I can get a lot of people together in this building who are very worried about global warming. They're worried about the permitting process that's involving less iron work and less hours. And that's part of the fissure in America that Trump, by promising people who feel left behind in the working, if you work with your hands in America, you've not had a good decade in most places. That's the resonant chord he struck.
When you're doing political marketing, does the truth matter? Because I'm going to be straight up, feels like it doesn't.
It's the perception of truth that matters. What is perceived to be true in politics and in many things is true. So, you know, we're not in an absolute truth business in politics. We are in creating the dominant perception and having that resonate to people, believing that'll help their lives improve. People are very suspicious of politics. They don't believe much. So what you try to do is find something that is objectively true about your candidate and amplify that and make the campaign about that. Do people believe that Trump is an outsider who will have hostile instincts to the existing power structure in D.C.? Yes, they believe that, and that is true. So what Trump did was make that important. I'm going to use that hostility I have to the system to drain the swamp that people perceive is how D.C. operates. I would disagree, but they perceive that. I am going to solve the problem of immigration because the problems we have in America are based on cheap labor from Mexico. Again, not true, but perceived to be true. I'll bet we could canvass the site back here and get some agreement on that. And so that's where the linkage between Trump's persona and people's worries came together.
Yikes.
Yeah. Oh, it's powerful. But objective truth, fine print, not that true. On the other hand, Hillary Clinton, you know, I mean, even a better example is the Trump of the left, Bernie Sanders. Now, he doesn't have the racial dimension of Trump to his credit, because Trump did, I believe, use the subtext to racism shamefully in his campaign. It's one of the reasons I opposed him. But Bernie says, Trump tells the iron workers, some guy in Mexico wants to steal your job. You have an enemy now. I'm going to fix that enemy. Your life will get better. Bernie Sanders says you really want to get that PhD in aromatherapy candle making, but it'll cost you $350,000 in student debt. That's unfair. You should get it for free. Who will pay? Wall Street. They have all the money. There's a big room where they have gold coins and they shovel it. Again, simple enemy. I'll solve it.
Understood.
And so there's a real symmetry between the two appeals.
I'm afraid we're all out of time, but I would love to keep on talking. Thank you so much for joining us
today. Well, thank you. It's great to be here, and I look forward to getting any angry tweets off this interview at Murphy Money.
Okay.
Thanks.
Office Hours was produced by the Belfer Center for Science and International Affairs at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government.